What can we learn from history about our current state of global disorder? Henry Kissinger will join us to talk about his new book, World Order.
We can't go from where we are to an idyllic world, but we ought to understand the process in which we are engaged, and we ought to make a big contribution to shaping it.
How did Jimmy Carter, Menachem Begin, and Anwar Sadat achieve a moment of Middle Eastern peace at Camp David? Lawrence Wright will join us to talk about his new book, 13 Days in September.
These guys were, they had blood on their hands. They were very obstinate and difficult personalities. And if those people can make peace, then I think that, leaders today could do a better job.
Alexander Alter will be here to talk about what's going on this week in the book world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Henry Kissinger needs very little introduction. His new book is World Order, reviewed this week on the cover of the Book Review by John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Dr. Kissinger, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
In your acknowledgments, you said that this book grew out of a conversation you had with the former diplomat, now at Yale, Charles Hill. Can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of the book and why now?
Charlie Hill and I have been working together for decades. He was on the policy planning staff of the State Department when I was secretary, and we've been meeting off and on quite frequently. And we were having dinner, and I was telling him that I was considering writing a book on major personalities and their impact on the events that I saw. And he made the point that this is really, again, redoing the past, and I should try to write about what the most important contemporary problem was. And I thought about that, and then I asked myself, what is the most important contemporary problem? And that led me to the book that I finally wrote. It took over 2 years to do.
What is it that that you see as the major contemporary problem and the main argument that you seek to make in the book?
The major problem that I see is this, that the first time in history, the different parts of the world can interact with each other, and that the problem of stability and progress depends on their ability to interact. But they are operating on different value systems and on different conceptions of order. That is one problem. The second problem is that within regions, the established order is breaking down. For example, in the Middle East, you have uprisings or challenges to governments, challenges between religious groups, and challenges to the borders that were drawn on which the states are based, which would represent the units by which the Europeans and we ordered the world. Those are the fundamental challenges I try to deal with, and I try to explain their origin and in some cases directions. But my major concern has been to enable people to understand the world in which we live and the scope of where we might go.
Let's talk about the Middle East for a moment. Obviously, very much in the news, Obama just gave his speech advocating intervention in Syria without committing ground troops. What did you make of his plan to counteract ISIS?
I think it's a plan. It is very reasonable. There are a number of things that we will have to reflect about. One is, the plan is very importantly based on the ability to generate Sunni ground forces to fight this, what is essentially a Sunni revolution. It's not self-evident that we will be able to find these ground forces, in part because of the suspicions that have arisen between us and some of the Sunni states like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. The second problem is that we rely very heavily on the reconstituted Baghdad government that then is expected to bring about a unified Iraq and is expected to motivate the Sunni part of Iraq so that it can bear the brunt of the ground fighting. That's very problematical. I don't object to it in theory. I have questions about its feasibility.
You've said that previously that you support intervention if there is a clear objective in Syria. What do you think that objective should be? And do you think that Obama articulated a clear objective in his speech?
I think we have to separate two things. I support attacking ISIS bases in Syria. And they're clearly identifiable. And that is a definable objective. I would be very uneasy about military intervention in Syria's general civil war at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not construe what the president said last night as a request for an authority or of an intention to do an open-ended military operation in Syria. But if that was implied, I would think it would be very risky.
How big a threat? I mean, obviously, there are so many parts moving right now in the Middle East. How big a threat is ISIS compared with the situation in Iran?
The situation in Iran, ISIS is one of these movements that break out occasionally and sweep all before them, but have a very limited base in their origin. So ISIS is an immediate, urgent problem. Iran is a long-term problem, under its present leadership, because it's an established state with a long history. The one state conquered by the Arab world in the aftermath of the Islamic emergence that maintained its language and its culture. So it has a strong sense of identity. And so its impact over a long period of time is going to be greater than ISIS would be in its present dimensions. In addition, and most importantly, if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, or if it emerges out of these negotiations with the equivalence of nuclear weapons, that will change the balance of expectations and of assessments in the region. So to deal with Iran is a more fundamental, long-term problem, and it's must be an essential component of the American policy.
Looking at that long view, obviously you wrote this book before this most recent crisis. How would the lessons of your book apply to the current situation in the Middle East?
The lessons of the book are that, first of all, we must be very clear about our objectives and their feasibility. And we must think about not only the military outcome, but the political evolution in the region. Third, we have to understand the things we must do, but also the things we can only do together with allies, and it cannot be done without allies. So I think a substantial ground combat against ISIS, which is, after all, a force of only 20,000 people, that cannot be an American effort. except by air power. There are two major points, I think, I'm trying to make in the book. One is, we have been engaged in five wars since 1945, and we have managed to achieve our objectives in only one, the first Gulf War, and we had sort of a draw in the Korean War, but we unilaterally withdrew essentially from Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That means that we didn't have our political and military objectives lined up, and that should not be repeated as a general proposition. Secondly, as a nation, we should think about three things. What are the objectives which are so essential to us, or security that's so essential to us, that we must operate, if necessary, alone? What must we do, or can we do only multilaterally, that is, together with allies? And third, what should we not do at all?
Mm-hmm.
And those principles, I think, should be applied in the execution of the policy. But I agree with what the president has outlined yesterday. But that's only the beginning of a process.
How would you answer those questions? The first question, for example, the objectives. What do you see looking at the current situation, not only in the Middle East, but in the Ukraine, in the South China Sea? What do you see as objectives that are so essential that, if necessary, we should forego that shared international vision and go it alone?
We've discussed the Middle East previously. Here in Ukraine, it is very difficult to go it. We shouldn't go it alone. We should operate with a European consensus, because Ukraine is organically part of a region whose history has always been influenced by all of its components. We have important interests, and it is against our interest to establish, to permit the principle to be established where a country can violate the borders of its neighbors out of long-term historical convictions about the nature of its patrimony. But I certainly would not consider military actions of any kind in that region without significant European support. But I would also feel that the ultimate objective in the region should be to keep open the possibility of an ultimate cooperation between Russia and Europe and the United States. And that means that we should attempt together with others to end this confrontational phase by seeing whether it is possible to establish a Ukraine that will be free to live its own life, that forgoes links with military blocs, either of the West or of Russia, and that acts as a bridge between East and West, rather than as an outpost of either the East or the West against the other.
What do you think so far of Kerry's tenure as Secretary of State?
He's inherited multiple revolutions and challenges around the world, and he has shown great courage in tackling them and enormous dedication in tackling them. It's too early to tell what the outcome of these efforts will be. And you know, I attended something in Washington last week where six former secretaries of state were blessing the opening of a center of diplomacy together with Secretary Kerry. So as former secretaries of state, we are usually very reluctant attack our successors, because we know how hard that job is and how painful the choices are. But that was the basic theme all of us spoke on.
It seems that the current moment is especially difficult. Yours is the first of a wave of books coming in the next month or two that seem to address this sense that global affairs and the U.S. policy, foreign policy, is in disarray. Do you think that that's the case?
I think that the development of outrunning policy, yes, so in that sense. But it's also a great challenge and a great opportunity. And we can't go when we use the word world order, we can't go from where we are to an idyllic world. But we ought to understand the process in which we are engaged, and we ought to make a big contribution to shaping it.
Well, the book could not be more timely. Dr. Kissinger, thank you so much for joining us and for your time.
Thank you for this interview. I enjoyed it.
Henry Kissinger is the author most recently of World Order, reviewed this week on the cover of the book review by John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Alexandra Alter joins me now to talk about what's going on in the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So lots of Booker news.
Yes, the shortlist came out this week. And as we talked about before, this is the first year that writers outside of the UK and the Commonwealth and the former Commonwealth countries were eligible. So there were a bunch of Americans on the long list, and two made it onto the shortlist.
They've kept two. So who's on the shortlist? And then let's talk quickly about who was eliminated.
Yes. So Joshua Ferris is on the shortlist for To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, which is an interesting novel about a dentist who is opposed to technology but has his identity sort of stolen online. And Karen Joy Fowler was nominated and made the shortlist for her novel, We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, which is a little more commercial than they usually go. It's got a big blurb from Khaled Hosseini, and, you know, she's sort of known as a more popular author.
We reviewed it on our cover.
Yeah.
All right. What else is on there?
So then beyond
the non-Americans.
Beyond the two Americans, there are British authors Howard Jacobson, Neil Mukherjee, and Ali Smith. And those are all being moved up by American publishers. American publishers are not only thrilled that they have their own authors this year, but they've also acquired these books by nominated authors. So it turns out that Neil Mukherjee's book is being moved to October 1st, and Norton just bought it a couple of weeks ago in August. So that's a pretty quick turnaround to get that book out.
Wreaking havoc on us book review
assigners. Exactly. We're all rushing now to read it, which is exactly what they were going for, I'm sure. And Hogarth moved up the American release date for Howard Jacobson's Jay, which is a dystopian drama sort of set in the future. And it's been compared to George Orwell and stuff. It's gotten really good reviews in the UK. So that was planned for next spring, and now it's coming out in October. And
Ali Smith also was supposed to be in the spring.
Ali Smith was, yeah, they actually were waiting for the shortlist announcement, they told me, before they set their U.S. publication date. So now that's coming out on December 2nd.
Making it a much busier fall.
And then we didn't mention Richard Flanagan, the Australian novelist. His book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, is already out here.
And who fell off the list?
So David Mitchell did not make the shortlist, and this was his fifth nomination. So that was probably sad for some of his fans. And a few other of the Americans who were nominated for the long list didn't make it. Siri Hustvedt, Richard Powers, and Joseph O'Neill, who has dual citizenship, did not make the short list.
And David Nichols with Us also failed to make the shortlist cut.
That's right.
And when is the Booker Prize announced?
So the winner will be announced on October 14th.
All right. Well, the literary award season heats up. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Lawrence Wright joins me now. He is the author of 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David, reviewed this week on the cover of the book review by Joe Klein. Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So this book has an interesting origin because it started off as a play.
Yeah, it's sort of backward from the normal progression. I didn't have a book that I would have adapted for the play. So I researched the play the way that I would writing a book or a New Yorker story. I interviewed the Carters. I went to the Middle East and talked to all the surviving members of those delegations and wrote the play, which had been commissioned by the Arena Stage in Washington. Gerald Rafshoon was the producer of the play, and he had been Carter's media advisor, and he's the one who approached me initially about doing a play.
How did you come to write the book? Once the play was written, did you think this needs to be a book as well?
Yeah, I was really struck by the fact that this event, which was really one of the great diplomatic triumphs of the 20th century, was so obscure, and people knew so little about how peace had been made. And, you know, honestly, people begin to feel that the Middle East is destined to always be in conflict. And yet, on one 13-day period, three men got together at Camp David, and they made an enduring peace. So Camp David shows us that peace is possible even in the Middle East.
All right, well, let's go back to that period. Lay the groundwork, if you will, about the events in the Middle East that led up to the peace talks at Camp David.
Well, since Israel's founding in 1948, there had been four wars between Israel and Egypt. Five, actually, if you count the War of Attrition, which went on for a couple of years between two of those wars. In 1973, Sadat, the president of Egypt at the time, surprised Israel with a massive invasion across the Suez Canal and into Sinai, which Israel had occupied since the 1967 war, and it had shaken Israel profoundly, that Egypt and also Syria had struck with such force in such a surprising moment. You know, Israel had been rather secure, feeling a little smug, perhaps, about its position in the Middle East, and that war was extremely unsettling. There were many people in Israel that thought we could never let go of the Sinai, because if we didn't have that 150 miles of sand separating us from the main Egyptian forces, then we might have been conquered entirely by the Egyptians. And in Egypt, Sadat was alone in his desire to make peace with Israel. Two of his foreign ministers resigned after he made a trip to Jerusalem in November of 1977 to talk about peace to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Arab and Muslim worlds were very much opposed to this overture. So you had two men who did not have very much backing in their countries for making peace, and you had the third man, Jimmy Carter, who was had a very beleaguered presidency. He had been very popular when he was elected, actually higher popularity than Ronald Reagan ever achieved.
But that didn't last.
No, unfortunately, it plummeted steeply and sharply. And by the time Camp David came around, he was mired in double-digit inflation, and the Shah was going down in Iran. The world was in flames. So, you know, when you reflect on this, you think about these three men, one of them, Anwar Sadat, an assassin, a Nazi sympathizer, and another, Menachem Begin, who was a terrorist. And then you have Jimmy Carter flailing at that moment in his presidency. What an unlikely cast of characters to achieve peace in the Middle East. But what more unlikely people could there have been than the three men that made peace at Camp David? And as far as timing goes, you know, the region was still rocking from the 73 war. And yet, you know, even in that very difficult time, they managed to forge an agreement that has endured without a single violation for more than 35 years.
Let's talk. You can see why this would make a great play, because you have these three incredible characters. But let's talk one by one about the three real life players, starting with Begin.
Begin's life was overshadowed by the Holocaust. He lost his parents and his brothers to the Holocaust in Poland. And he was very influenced by a man named Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was a ferocious Zionist. Begin went to see him when he was 15 years old, and it transformed his life. He decided to give his whole career to the cause. And the Jabotinsky view of the Promised Land of Israel was not just Judea and Samaria, what we consider the West Bank, but what is now the Kingdom of Jordan as well. He had a very expansionist view of what Israel should be, and Begin believed that as well. When he got to Israel, he became the leader of a terrorist organization called Irgun. And they were at that time creating actions against the British Army, which has the mandate to rule Palestine at the time. It was under Begin's leadership that the King David Hotel in Jerusalem was destroyed with nearly 100 fatalities. It was also Irgun people that he sent into action against Deir Yassin, a Palestinian village where so many people were killed, and it prompted the mass exodus of Palestinians. So Begin had a lot of blood on his hands, and he was responsible for a lot of the tragedy that had unfolded in that region. Sadat, I happened to be living in Egypt in 1970 when Gamal Abdel Nasser, the formidable Egyptian president, died of a heart attack, and Sadat became the president. And at the time, he was seen as a placeholder, a very weak successor to Nasser. And yet he proved himself to be very active. Within a year, he had rounded up many of Nasser's cronies and thrown them in jail. And threw out all the Soviet advisors. He was an earth shaker, and nobody knew what to expect from him. And when he went to Jerusalem in November of 77, the entire world was absolutely shaken by the fact that an Arab would fly into the heart of Israel and address the Knesset and offer terms of peace. I think he understood that Egypt would never progress as long as it was engaged in this conflict with Israel. Four wars in a single generation, it had impoverished the country, it had thwarted any kind of development, and it also had left Egypt in a state of being a kind of vassal state to the Soviets until he actually threw the Soviets out of his country. He understood that Egypt was paralyzed, and he needed to do something to break the kind of psychology that had imposed itself on the region that said that peace would never be possible.
What about Carter? I mean, people look back at his presidency and today typically write it off as this, you know, terrible failure. But this was really a moment of triumph for him.
It was one of the greatest diplomatic triumphs of the 20th century, a really remarkable event. And I think that Carter was so unpopular when he left office that people didn't want to give him credit for achieving this. But, you know, it's fascinating to think about, first of all, the presumption that this one-term governor from Georgia could go into an issue as thorny as the Middle East conflict and actually believe that he could bring peace to that region.
What qualities does Carter have that made him capable of achieving the agreement?
Well, some of the things that caused him so much grief as president, for instance, his micromanaging, were very important at Camp David. Hans Mark, who was at that time the head of the National Reconnaissance Office, was asked by the Carter administration to supply a large map of the Sinai for Carter at Camp David so he could study it. So he had a very large map printed out and sent over to Camp David, and he was told, no, we mean a big map, 14 by 17 feet, that would cover the entire space of this room so Carter could get down on his hands and knees. and examine every little wadi and settlement in the region. That kind of minutia, that attention to detail, was essential at Camp David. He had all of these facts at his fingertips, and in many ways was far more in command of the situation than Sadat and Begin were. And so it left him in a much stronger position. He was not talking about overarching generalities. He was talking about very, very specific things. And that stood him in good stead in that very difficult discussion.
So these three men arrive in Camp David. Did it seem destined for success from the beginning? How were the first few days?
Carter had a naive notion that he could bring these two men together, both men he thought of goodwill, put them in an isolated environment, and they would get to know each other. And then they would trust one another, and they would find a way to peace. Well, after 2 days, he had to physically separate them. Rosalind Carter told me that, you know, she could hear them screaming at each other for hours. It was, they just hated each other. And so Plan A did not work
That
out.
Did not work.
And Carter had been reluctant to put forward an American plan. Obviously, it would place him in an awkward position if it failed. And yet they needed a third party to achieve a peace they both wanted but couldn't make between the two of them. So Carter drafted what he called it, you know, he came to call it a single text document. He had a legal pad, and he wrote out what were at the beginning about 30 major areas of conflict, everything from removing the settlements, the Israeli settlements in Sinai, to removing the military government in the West Bank, demilitarizing Sinai. There, you know, all of these things that he felt had to be accomplished. And then each day, and sometimes several times a day, he would present the revised draft to both sides. And as they agreed to the language of one small item, he would scratch that off and eventually shave down to the single issues that remained, so that, you know, one by one, all of these major issues had been negotiated and agreed to. And finally, you know, the 27th draft, that was the Camp David Accords.
Over the course of those 13 days, was there a key moment or a turning point?
There were two moments, I think, that were really key. One was the moment when Carter realized that he was going to have to take control. And he had to become the leader of that negotiation, not just a facilitator. In that moment, he put America's prestige on the line, and also the relationship of each of these countries to America. It wasn't just them trying to make peace with each other. Carter made it very clear that they were going to have trouble with the United States if they failed, if they walked away from this agreement. And that was key. Another moment was on the sixth day, after so much anguish and so many bad feelings, and, you know, for several days, Begin and Sadat hadn't seen each other at all. Carter decided to take a break and take them to Gettysburg, the battlefield, which was nearby. It was, I think, a sobering reminder of the consequences of war when they looked out on these, you know, all these gravestones. And it was a turning point in American history. Begin, by that time, had been a very isolated figure, even in his own delegation, which was far more interested in promoting peace than he seemed to be. And as he stood alone by himself, as the others were looking over the battlefield, Rosalind Carter told me she heard him. He was saying very quietly the Gettysburg Address. And eventually everybody turned to him, and he recited by memory the Gettysburg Address. And Rosalind was just shaken, thinking maybe he really does know the advantages that peace would bring.
It's so easy to despair looking at the Middle East today with what seems like an endless round of conflict. Did writing this book change your perception of the current Arab-Israeli conflict?
Oh, very much so. For one thing, you know, This was when Carter and Begin and Sadat met at Camp David. It was the world was also in flames. It was a very difficult time. And they had been through years and years of warfare. So there was no perfect time to make peace, but they decided that they could make peace. There was going to be no better time in the future. There would be no stronger leaders. There would be no other better opportunity than to do what they were set out to do at Camp David. And as I said, you know, they were flawed men. These guys were, you know, they had blood on their hands. They were very obstinate and difficult personalities and flawed in very complicated ways. If those people can make peace, then I think that, you know, leaders today could do a better job.
Our current flawed leadership.
Well, we will always be cursed with flawed leadership. We're never going to be in a period of such enlightenment, especially in the Middle East, that suddenly peace will fall upon us without making any sacrifices. But what we can see in the Middle East is right now a tremendous Islamic civil war. There is a role, no doubt, for containing this conflict militarily, but that's not going to resolve anything. It can only be resolved at the peace table by, for instance, reconciliation among the Sunnis and the Shia in a grand gesture. That's the only way that the current conflicts can be resolved.
The book, again, is 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. Joe Klein, reviewing it on the cover of the book review this week, calls it magnificent. Lawrence Wright, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Pamela. Thanks for having me.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
There's a lot going on the list this week.
There is a lot going on the adult hardcover list this week. I am going to do just a quick rundown of the children's lists where there's less happening. The middle grade list has one new title. It's by James Patterson, writing with Chris Grabenstein. It's a book called Treasure Hunters, new at number 8. Then at Picture Books, there are two new titles on the list, one at number 7. Lauren Long continues his Otis the Tractor series of picture books with Otis and the Scarecrow. And at number 10, Amy Krauss Rosenthal has a book called Uni the Unicorn. And the last new children's book this week is on the series list. Sarah J. Maas has the third book in her Throne of Glass series. It's called Heir of Fire, which was enough to push the Throne of Glass series onto the series list for the first week. That's new at number 4.
And on to Adult Matters.
There are 7 new books on the hardcover fiction list this week, almost half the list, and most of those are series books, starting down at number 13 with a paranormal series by Sherilyn Kenyon. Book 18 of her Dark Hunter series is called Son of No One.
Time to go back and read the first 17.
Yeah. Then head right on to Christine Fien's Dark series, which is also known as the Carpathian series, because book 26 of that series is out now. That's called Dark Blood. It's new at number 12 by Christine Fien. And then all 5 of the other new titles on the list this week are at the very top of the list. We have new books at 1 through 5, so I'll just count them down from 5 down. At number 5, Clive Cussler and Russell Blake continue the Fargo Adventures series with The Eye of Heaven. At number 4, Tana French continues her series of mysteries set in the Dublin Murder Squad. Each of those books kind of looks at a different detective on the fictional Dublin Murder Squad. This book is called The Secret Place. That's new at number 4. Then, not a series book, although it does pull in elements of each of his previous novels, the cult literary novelist and now just huge name literary novelist.
Now just mainstream.
David Mitchell, of course, of Cloud Atlas fame, has a new novel out. It's called The Bone Clocks, and that makes its debut on the list at number 3. Then back to the series again. Jan Karen's Mitford series continues with Somewhere Safe with Somebody Good. That is new at number 2. And finally, Lee Child's Jack Reacher series has a new book out called Personal, and that's new at number 1.
Nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there are 3 new titles. A journalist named Dana Goldstein has written her first book. It's called The Teacher Wars, and it is kind of a cultural history that looks back at 175 years of the teaching profession in public schools, battles over pay and unionization and curriculum. A lot of this stuff that we're still fighting over today really goes back, you know, more than 100 years, and different constituencies have been fighting it out for just that long.
Just to start the back-to-school year on a cheery note.
That book is new at number 8. Then, again, the other two books are both at the top of the list this week. At number 2, Phil Robertson, the Duck Commander from the Duck Dynasty series, has written a new book with Mark Schlebach, who's written all of those Duck Dynasty books with the family. This book is called Unfiltered. That's filtered, P-H-I-L. Phil Robertson got in trouble last year in a profile for GQ, making comments against homosexuality, suggesting that blacks didn't have it so hard in the pre-civil rights era. The A&E network that runs Duck Dynasty suspended him for a few shows. He expands on those comments and tries to explain himself a bit in this new book, Unfiltered. It's a look at what Phil Robertson thinks about a whole lot of things.
Clearly not slowed down on the bestseller list.
Then finally, the number one book on the hardcover nonfiction list this week is by a guy named Randall Monroe. He's a former roboticist for NASA who has gone on to run a website, a wildly popular website called xkcd.com. That answers scientific questions. He uses little stick figure cartoons to illustrate ideas. He takes kind of a quirky, eccentric approach to scientific questions. And he's done a whole book called What If? That gives serious scientific answers to basically stupid questions. Like, if you were to eat this book, how many calories does it contain? Things like that. How high would you have to drop a steak from outer space in order to have it be cooked by the time it reaches Earth? Questions like that.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.